Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of interviews with top scientists and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, sky watching the star Spica, what science says about our fingers, exploring the dwarf planet Pluto, and behind the scenes of a NASA mission to Mars. Here's the scientist's soundbite.
Pluto is a planet. It's really the Earth-like worlds and the gas giants that are the misfits. It's Pluto that's the most common type, the dwarf planets, in our solar system and probably across the galaxy.
You're listening to planetary scientist Alan Stern of the Southwest Research Institute. Dr. Stern heads a NASA mission called New Horizons on its way to explore Pluto, which was once known as a planet until astronomers demoted it to dwarf planet status. He spoke by telephone to give us an update on New Horizons and his thoughts on the Pluto controversy.
I think it's pretty obvious to many, if not most, planetary scientists that objects of this scale, thousands of kilometers across, are planets. They have all the attributes of planets. They have crusts and cores. They have atmospheres, moons. They have seasons. And we could go on down the list. To every recognizable attribute that we associate with planethood, Pluto is a planet. And many planetary scientists and, of course, many people in the public just discount the IAU's wrong-headed vote. In fact, Pluto is actually the heralder, if you will, of the largest structure in our solar system, the Kuiper Belt, of a third class of planets in our solar system, the dwarf planets, the first binary planet ever discovered. It's headlined all the way down the list.
As the principal investigator of the New Horizons mission, I'd like your thoughts on that mission launched by NASA to fly by Pluto. What's the status right now? How's it going?
Oh, it's going great. Thanks for asking. You know, in 2003, the National Academy of Sciences released their decadal survey for the 2000s and ranked the exploration of the Pluto system and its cohort objects in the Kuiper Belt, the other planets that are there, to be the number one priority for the New Frontiers program of large planetary missions. And out of that came New Horizons through a competition, and we built it and tested it on the ground, and then we launched it in January of 2006 on a nearly 10-year voyage all the way across the depths of space to the farthest planet ever explored. Even though we're the fastest mission ever launched, and we're traveling 1,000,000 miles per hour, it takes 9.5 years to get there. And today, we're well past halfway. The spacecraft is past the orbit of Uranus and is speeding on towards its arrival at the Pluto system in July of 2015. And we can't wait for 2015 in 4 years.
Maybe you could describe for us what some of the equipment on New Horizons will do. Maybe you could tell us about some of the highlights of what New Horizons will find out ultimately when it reaches Pluto.
We've got 8 scientific instruments on board. And that includes multiple cameras, some spectrometers that tell us about the composition of both the atmosphere and the surface. We can measure the temperature of the surface. And we also have instruments that will sniff the products of the atmosphere that are escaping to space. And we have radio science, as many other planetary missions do as well, to help us determine the bulk temperature of the surface. It'll help us probe the atmosphere, and it'll also help us determine the mass of Pluto and some of its satellites. Those 8 instruments have 3 primary objectives and then about 20 more secondary objectives. The 3 primary objectives are surface mapping, surface composition, and atmospheric structure and composition. In fact, New Horizons is carrying a more sophisticated payload to a first-time encounter with a planet than has ever been done in the history of space exploration, and the data sets are going to knock your socks off.
What is the biggest scientific question mark that that you have, or maybe your peers, astronomers, have about Pluto? What is that burning question about it that just that we don't know and that might be illuminated by the New Horizons mission?
So with Pluto, I think the most important thing is that we have never sent a spacecraft to a dwarf planet before. We've been to the terrestrial planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. We've been to the 4 giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. But this new class of world, you know, that Pluto represents, and it may be the most populous class of planet in the galaxy, we have never been able to reconnoiter before. And so we're going on New Horizons with our eyes wide open. It's really going to be revolutionary. And so the most interesting thing to look for is how this new third class of planet is like and how it has evolved through time.
That was Alan Stern, Associate Vice President of the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We'd love to hear from you on Facebook. Tell us where you're from. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky. Deborah Bird joins us now to talk about the global night sky. Welcome, Deborah.
Hello, Jorge.
Hiya.
Star of the week, Spica, in the constellation Virgo. No matter where you are on Earth, you can see this star. If you're in the northern hemisphere, you want to look in the southeast in the evening. If you're in the southern hemisphere, you want to look more overhead. Now, Spica's constellation Virgo is a really large, kind of faint constellation. So when you look for this star, you're not going to see a lot of other bright stars around it. However, this year, the planet Saturn is nearby. So if you look in the southeast, you'll see two objects up there. One will be a blue-white star, Spica, and the other will be a golden planet, Saturn.
So, Deborah, how does one see Spica in the night sky?
Well, if you're in the northern hemisphere, it's really easy because there's a saying that Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and people who know the sky know, and that saying is, follow the arc to Arcturus and speed on to Spica. So again, you have to be in the northern hemisphere to do this because you have to be able to see the Big Dipper. But at this time of year, the Big Dipper is in the northeastern sky. It has a bowl and a handle. And if you follow the curve in the Big Dipper's handle, you come to the bright orange star Arcturus. And if you keep going with that curve, you'll come to Spica. So follow the arc to Arcturus and speed on to Spica. But if you don't want to remember all that, just remember to go outside in the evening. If you're in the northern hemisphere, look in the southeast. Two objects, the golden one is Saturn, the blue-white one is Spica. Or if you're in the southern hemisphere, same deal, two objects close together, but more overhead in the evening.
And one of the things that I found interesting about Spica, it's a blue giant star. It's a binary star system, right?
That's right. Actually, Spica is two stars. And what's really cool about these two stars that we see as that single point of light, that Spica, is that they're so huge. They're bigger stars and hotter stars than our sun, and yet they're very, very close together. And when two such massive objects are so close together, they orbit each other very quickly. So Earth, for example, takes 365 days to orbit the sun once. These two giant stars in the Spica binary system orbit each other in only 4 days.
That's amazingly close, and you can't even resolve these two stars with the naked eye. You need a telescope for that.
No, if you look in the sky, you just see one star because they're so close together. But it's so cool to think that as we stand here on Earth, when you start to know about astronomy, you find out that all these little points of light you see as the stars are so different from each other. There's so much going on up there. It's really cool. Let me say one more thing about Spica, and that is because these two giant stars are orbiting each other so close together, their gravity is pulling on each other, and it's distorting the shape of the stars into kind of an egg-shaped. So whereas our sun, if you look at pictures of the sun, you know it's round. These two stars in the Spica binary system are kind of shaped like eggs with the pointed ends facing each other. And that is our star of the week, Spica, and the constellation Virgo.
That's great. Yeah, so that's in the east in the evening.
The southeast in the evening sky is seen from the northern hemisphere and more overhead if you're in the southern hemisphere. And Jorge, before I go, I want to say one thing, and that is don't forget to look in the morning sky for the moon, the waning crescent moon, near a very bright planet, which will be Venus. There are actually four other planets nearby. They're going to be a lot harder to see. The one you're going to have the easiest time seeing is the planet Jupiter, which is also very bright. in the east before dawn, the moon will be close to Venus on April 29th and 30th. Also look for Jupiter nearby. Mercury, Mars, and Uranus are there too. You're going to have a lot tougher time seeing those. But April 29th and 30th, pre-dawn sky, look in the east. It's going to be cool.
The Global Night Sky with Deborah Burr. Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. On Weird Science Today, Ryan Britton brings us some interesting science about human digits, fingers, and what they can tell us about ourselves. Ryan, welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing great. So this isn't going to be about palm reading, is it?
No, not exactly. What I'd like to bring to you today is the potential significance of what's called the 2D-4D ratio. So like for everyone to hold up their hands, put your palms together like you were administering an oath. And if you look at the tips of your fingers, your 2D to 4D ratio is a ratio between your index finger or your pointer and your ring finger or your third finger. So we're a couple of males here in the studio, and my index finger is a bit shorter than my ring finger, and this is actually, you know, most common in males. So there's some scientific evidence that a longer ring finger in relation to the index finger means you got more male testosterone exposed to you in the womb.
Rawr.
Exactly, exactly. So it's a very crude or primitive indicator, to say the least, but women tend to have index fingers that are relatively the same length as their ring fingers. Sometimes their index fingers are slightly longer.
So what's the science here? What does it all mean?
So this is where it gets cool. There are studies out there starting way back in 1930 that say that this ratio could mean a lot of things. There's a study in April of 2011 published by the Royal Society that found out that males, as rated by women, with a bigger 2D-4D ratio, again, you know, shorter index finger relative to their ring finger, these guys tended to be more attractive or masculine or, you know, basically hotter. Hmm. And the theory goes that they receive more testosterone in the womb, and somehow that made them more male-looking or attractive. But I want to point out one thing about this study that's interesting. The study found that these males with a higher ratio did not necessarily sound sexier or smell more attractive to females. They were just better looking. And then going back to the ratio, there's a study by the University of Cambridge in 2009 where males with a bigger 2D to 4D ratio made better traders in financial markets. They were a bit better when they worked within the high stress, market competitions and, you know, risk taking, that type of thing. So these are just a couple of examples of kind of this interesting ratio that science continues to study.
It's not quite palm reading, but it's the study of people's fingers.
That's right. And you can find out more information at the Royal Society Journal. That's at rsp.royalsocietypublishing.org. But then there also has been, you know, like I mentioned, quite a bit of research on this. So it's probably best to first Google that 2D to 4D ratio for an overview.
Cool. Thanks, Ryan.
Sure.
Earth Sky's Ryan Britton with Weird Science. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at EarthSky.org. Beth Lebwohl joins us now in the studio on an interview with a science writer embedded on a NASA mission to Mars. Welcome, Beth.
Hey, thank you, Jorge. So I spoke with Brooklyn-based science writer Andrew Kessler, who just wrote a book called Martian Summer, Robot Arms, Cowboy Spacemen, and My 90 Days with the Phoenix Mars Mission. And he wrote essentially about the summer of 2008, which he spent in Tucson, Arizona, embedded with Mission Control. That is a team of about 130 experts who were conceiving, operating from moment to moment, NASA's Phoenix Mars Lander mission.
That's pretty much every space buff's dream, is to spend 90 days at NASA behind a really important mission that explored Mars back in 2008.
Yes, yes, living the dream. And he was actually commissioned by a fellow named Peter Smith, who is heading up the entire mission.
Yeah, let's hear Andrew Kessler explain what the Mars Phoenix mission was all about.
So all of these missions, we've gone and we've tried to find organic material on Mars, and all of our experiments have returned nothing. So Viking did these experiments, and they said, nope, there's no organic material on Mars. And so now this mission, Phoenix, comes along and discovers this weird chemical on the surface of Mars. It's perchlorate is a oxidizer. And so basically, the way that they were looking for organic material is to heat up the soil samples on all these past missions. And so what was happening is that the perchlorate was burning up the sample before they would see the signature and destroying the evidence of organic material. So basically, all our conventional wisdom was saying, oh, we don't see any organic material on Mars, which is a big indicator that there would be some kind of life or something there. And now the discovery of perchlorate forces us to look for that organic material in a new way without heating up the sample.
Tell us more. What do you think the public should know about the NASA Phoenix Mars Lander mission?
Well, I think they should know just how hard it is to make this thing work and how dedicated the people that work on the mission are to making it work. Every day that the lander powers up and extends its robot arm, digs it into the Martian soil, that is a miracle. It is amazing. It takes a mountain of effort. And the people who make that happen are kind of heroes. They're these unsung heroes. They really have this dedication to what they do that's really profound, I think. And what's missing is that their story is kind of glossed over. And I try to with the book, Martian Summer, make these technical details accessible. The main kind of core instrument on the Phoenix Mars mission was this 8-foot-long arm. The job of the mission was to dig stuff up on the North Pole of Mars. So they were going to go and dig up ice if it was there, or they were going to reach under the surface, right? And this was the first time we really kind of dug into Mars. Before, we kind of scratched at the surface, and now we were going to dig. So we had this 8-foot-long arm with a little backhoe at the end, and its job was to acquire samples and then put them in the scientific instruments. In fact, the thing that they're doing, making this arm move down to the soil, to the Mars dirt, to touch it and then acquire a little sample, is really, really difficult because, one, they can't just stick their head out the window of the lander and see where the arm is, right? Everything they do is filtered through this 200 million mile lens. And that really complicates the picture. And so what they liken it to is that they're kind of blindly digging around with a dustpan at the end of a fishing pole. And basically what they have to do is they have to find the surface. And there's no like pressure sensors or anything like this, based on these photos, three-dimensional photos that they have of the area. And then they press down and they have to acquire precise amounts of material so that the scientists can get good samples. And so doing this work is like, you know, playing the claw game across a football field or something, but then much harder. And these guys do it with just this quiet dignity. And every time you see, like, sample not acquired in the newspaper, you're like, ah, poor guys. You know, and you know that they spent all night looking at this 100-column matrix of data, trying to figure out how they're going to get this couple tablespoons of dirt into this instrument, and all that they get in the press is didn't work or couldn't get the dirt in. And then you think, wow, that's too bad.
That was science writer Andrew Kessler. His latest book is called Martian Summer. Thanks, Beth.
Hey, thank you, Jorge.
That's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week, we recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers, Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Mother Falcon, The Black and White Years, The Bright Light Social Hour, and 100 Flowers. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science. To take you out this week, Up by the Black and White Years.
Wake up, it's morning, as bloody and different as it ever was. I'm up and storming, as sadly imperious as my father was. I will not contribute to your next dull novel. My nonfiction takes on with the metronome in my chest. Each new city I roam reminds me always that my heart must wander. Where I am is my home. What I need is some rest. There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much art, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us. But we don't know, but we don't know, but we don't. What you don't know won't hurt ya. What you don't know won't have you terrified. What you don't know won't hurt ya. But you don't know, but you don't know, but you don't. Of the next stage. You don't.